Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and today our topic is storytelling in Alaska. And we are so blessed to have two fabulous storytellers on the program with us today. I'd like to welcome Polly Andrews. Hi, Polly.
Hi.
And Jack Dalton. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Polly's with me in the studio. Jack is all the way out there in Talkeetna, where he's being, I think, an artist in residence. Right, Jack?
Yes.
So he just scurried from the classroom to a telephone so he could join us on the program today. So thank you so much, Jack, for fitting us in.
You're very welcome.
Now, I wanted to start with, you know, I did all my little Wikipedia research about storytelling, and I also had just listened to some fabulous storytelling about a week ago at the Alaska Native Oratory Society. So I said, you know, what is it? What is it about a story that really captures us? Sometimes they're scary, sometimes they're funny, sometimes they make us relax, you know. So there's a famous professor from Duke who tried to capture what stories are. So I'm going to start with that. He says his name is Reynolds. I forgot his name, but he says a need to tell and hear stories is essential to the species Homo sapiens, second in necessity only to food and before love and shelter. Millions survive without love or home. Almost none survive in silence. The opposite of silence leads quickly to narrative, and the sound of story is the dominant sound in our lives, from the small accounts of our day's events to the vast, incommunicable constructs of psychopaths. So it's a huge gamut of storytelling. But stories obviously have power over us. And we're going to hear some amazing stories today from Jack and from Polly. And we invite our listeners, if you've got a little short story you can tell, you know, that you can sort of tell us quickly and you want to join in on the storytelling, please feel free to do that. You can reach us at on the program, Hometown Alaska, at 550-8433. And outside of Anchorage, call 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. This program is going to air again tonight at 7, but it won't be live, so you can't call in then. And before we get on with our storytelling, I just want to let folks know we have a lot of information on the website, a little bit of information about Polly and Jack, but also Arctic Entries is another opportunity here in Anchorage. We've got a link to their website. That is an urban storytelling group of people that puts on events in Anchorage, and they have something coming up and May 15th, so you might want to check their website out. And there's also lots of national storytelling resources, and so we have some of those links also on our website. And we have a link to Jack's site where you really learn a lot about Jack and about storytelling. And so anyway, it's a rich environment, and we're really going to have some fun today. I told Polly and Jack we'd start out with a story, so we're going to go to Jack and let him tell us a story.
Okay, thank you. And before I tell this this story, and it's going to be a shortened version of the story, the listeners should be warned there's a little bit of potty humor in it and some a mention of a few kind of gross things. But, I mean, if the kids can handle it at the schools, then I'm sure our listeners will be just fine.
Okay.
This is a Chugach, excuse me, this is a Chugach legend, and I learned it last year when I was asked to teach the Chugach legends at the Cultural Heritage Week in Tetitlik out in Prince William Sound. And I'm going to tell the version that I read in the book they gave me, and then we'll figure out something really amazing about it, because it in of itself is a little bit hard to understand. So here's how it goes. Here's a shortened version of it. Long, long ago, there was a woman who didn't want to get married until one day she realized that, my father and my brothers may not always be around to take care of me, so I better get married. She gets married, she goes with this man and lives on his beach in Prince William Sound. Now, he would go out hunting, and when he'd come back, she would say, "What have you brought back for me?" And all he seemed to bring her were guts. And she said, "My husband, if you love me, why would you only bring me guts?" And he would laugh, and he finally said, "My wife, not only are these guts, but these are the guts of your own family. Ha, 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 ha." And she said, "My husband, I do not believe you. I do not believe that you've killed my own family. Take me to them, and I'll see that they're still alive." He said, "Suit yourself." So they paddled across Prince William Sound to her family's home, and no one was there. He said, "I'm just going to leave you here. I don't need you anymore." And he paddled off without her. She did find her family. They were in the food cache, and they were gutted just as her husband had said. She was so sad and yet found a doll. And the doll started singing, and as the doll sang, her family came back to life. Well, they vowed revenge against this husband of their daughter and sister, and it just so happened that the husband was a son of the sun, so an S-O-N of the S-U-N. And the family of the wife was part of the family of alders, as in alder trees. And so this great war ensues. And the son said, "My sons and I are going to burn all of you and burn the whole earth, ha, ha, ha." And the alders said, "We will not let that happen. We are going to fight you." And this great war ensued. Now, every once in a while, the wife had a dog, and every once in a while, the dog would fart. And this big cloud would come, this fog would come all around Prince William Sound, and it would cool everything off. Meanwhile, the alders were trying to figure out how to keep the earth cool, and they decided to take control of the wind and take control of the weather, and they said, "Ha, ha, ha, sun, you cannot make it too warm. If you make it too warm, we'll make it rain and cloudy, and then it'll cool off, and if it doesn't rain, at least the clouds will be there to keep out your rays of sun." And the sun said, "I will take care of you. I'm going to burn all of you." And the sun devised to hurl all of these burning arrows down at the alders. And if you look at the bark of an alder tree, you'll see it has all these little bumps on it. And that's where all those burning arrows tried to get the alders. Luckily, they have very tough skin, so it didn't actually hurt them very much. Every once in a while, again, the dog would fart. Things would get foggy and cool off. And finally, the alders said, "You know, if it gets too hot, we're just going to go and hide under the ice. And once it gets cool again, we'll come back out and we're going to take back over the earth." On and on this went, back and forth, round and round. And finally, the alders said, "How can we keep this up, son? If you make things too hot, then nothing is going to be able to live on the earth. So why don't we come to some sort of peace, some sort of truce that says you can have part of the year to make things warm, and we will have the rest of the year to make things cool." And ever since that time, we've had the seasons, and ever since that time, there's been this tenuous peace between the alders and the sun. And every once in a while, the dog still farts.
Oh, wow. So it's an explanation of the seasons?
Well, that's what we thought at first. And actually, that was kind of stretching a little bit to make it seem more like it was about the seasons. But that you could guess. It took us a while. When I read the story to the kids, they were literally looking at me like I was absolutely crazy. And I said, "Well, let's talk about this story." So we were talking about it. And finally, one of the kids said, "Well, what if the ice is glaciers?" And suddenly, all of my knowledge about glaciation popped into my head, and I went, "Oh my gosh, this is a scientific observation story. This is a story about the advance and retreat of glaciers and the return of the forest to glaciated land afterwards. Plant succession." And in order to come upon this knowledge, you have to observe several advances and retreats of glaciers and the recolonization of plants to an area, which would take between 1,500 and 2,500 years of observation. And so everyone was thought, "Oh, that's really great. We figured out what the story was really about, this wonderful scientific record of glaciation." And then, of course, one of the kids had to ask, "Well, what about the dog farting?"
How does that fit in?
Yeah, and what we figured out is that the dog farting represented volcanic activity. Because the volcanoes put the sulfur dioxide in the air and actually will cool down the climate. And so that's what was going on there. And they said, "Well, how did they know the volcanoes were happening?" And, of course, there were volcanoes over in Cook Inlet and down the chain. But sometimes the volcanoes elsewhere, like Krakatoa, Tambora, Pinatubo back in the 80s, put enough sulfur dioxide in the air to actually cool off the temperatures. So they would probably be aware of some of those things going on. And, of course, you know, the sulfur stinks, the dog fart stinks because of the sulfur. It all makes perfect sense in the end.
It does. That's great.
And then they said, well, what about the guts? And I'm like, oh, that was probably just to get the kids interested in what they were talking about.
Something gross just to, exactly. To hook them. Exactly. So, yeah. Wow. And so you learned that there?
Yeah, we figured that out. And it reminded me, because I've read a lot of stories in the anthropological texts, that's what it came from, and they always seem so difficult to understand, and you were never quite sure what exactly were these stories about. Mm-hmm. So to be able to have time to work with the kids and actually really figure something out was really worth it, and actually inspired me.
Mm-hmm. And the clue really came from one of the listeners, right? The
exactly.
Yeah.
Huh.
So really, this is about how stories maybe don't travel in time as well, or have to, maybe they don't get captured right the first time, or what do you think, why do they become obscure and have to be sort of resorted out?
I think it was because there was sort of a natural declination of Native cultures due to the colonization of Alaska, the missionaries and things like that, the intrusion of the English language as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had these anthropologists that would come, and they recorded the stories and transliterated the stories, and you have to understand the difference between transliteration, translation, and interpretation. So transliteration is literally taking the word that is the native language and saying the, you know, exactly what it would be in the English language, and you keep the same grammar and syntax as the native language.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in itself can make a story difficult to understand. And so when you have people not telling the stories as much, and then they're being captured in these anthropological texts that didn't quite capture them in the purest form possible, because it was an interpretation would help us understand more what the original intent of the story was, whereas a transliteration is literally just a record that doesn't necessarily, doesn't translate as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it quickly gets academic, but before we go there, I just want to, remind people who we have. That's Jack Dalton you're listening to, just told us a story that is a natural observation story of glaciers and vegetation coming back on the land. And we have Polly Andrews in the studio with us also. And I want these folks to know, our listeners to know, where you come from, Jack, and why stories have that importance to you. And I'm going to ask Polly the same thing. So, Jack, let's start with you. Why are stories so embedded in you?
Not exactly sure. My mom is from the village of Hooper Bay, which is out on the Bering Sea coast, very close to Polly's village. And, in fact, we're relatives with the Chivac people. I was born in Bethel, and then when I was 5 days old, I was adopted by a non-Native family in Anchorage and grew up in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, my parents did the best they could, but this was back in the 70s, to let me know about my culture. I have a sister from Southeast Alaska. They did their best to let her know about her culture as well. But the resources were somewhat limited back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
In the 90s is when I met my birth mother and my birth family in Hooper Bay. And that's when the stories kind of started. They would, I'd hear stories from aunts and uncles and my mom. And I was interested because it was about who I was and where I came from, but it wasn't until a conference that I, through a series of very weird events, ended up telling a story in front of 3,000 indigenous people from around the world, something I'd never done before. And the power of that moment just really woke me up, and I realized that was my life's work, was to be a storyteller.
Really? It took an audience of 3,000.
Yeah.
And the fact that you, do you remember the story you told, or is that not important? It was just that you did it.
I do remember the story, and it is an important story. And it wasn't, it wasn't necessarily, because I'm trying not to make it too long a story, but it wasn't just the fact that there were 3,000 people there. It was the idea that the story kind of changed the way that conference was run. Because it reminded people that this was not an academic conference, even though it was about indigenous education, that it really should be a more indigenous conference. And the other big thing that really struck me was there was a Maori young man from Aotearoa, from New Zealand, who actually came up to me after the story and said that he believed the story saved his life and gave him a purpose.
Wow.
And so to hear someone say that they were considering suicide and then hear a story to let them know that their job is to go back and find elders and have the elders start talking again. It really hit home to me the power of oral narrative and our voices. And which I think is something we can talk about when we talk about the change in technologies.
Right. So, Polly, let's talk a little bit about you. Where are you from, and why did you go to storytelling? Why does it appeal to you?
Well, I'm originally from the community of Chivac, which is 18 miles away from where Jack is originally from, Hooper Bay. And my grandparents are the late Billy Ulhan Andrews, and my grandmother is Cecilia Ayukung Andrews. And when I was in my community growing up, I always heard these stories ever since I was a small child. You know, stories in our Alaska Native communities, rural communities, are used as a teaching tool more so than going to school and learning things, or we learn through stories from a young age about things we should do and things that we shouldn't do. And we learn about certain things that happened to people when they were out in the wilderness. We learn about, how our land originated or where our ancestors came from through these stories. And they always intrigued me. You know, growing up, when the sun was going down, I never heard, oh, you shouldn't stay out late because you're going to be tired for school tomorrow, or you shouldn't stay out till midnight because you are going to be grounded when you come home. But no, I heard you shouldn't stay out too late because that old grandmother who lives underneath that building over there is going to take you. She's going to put you in her parka, and no one will ever find you. It's stories like that that really stood out to me, you know, and it really motivates a child to, and a child remembers that story when it's getting dark out, and we want to go home. We want to listen to and give heed to these words that we were told and these stories that we were told, because they had an impact on us. Out of those,
it's much
many,
better than mm-hmm, saying there's is. A rule here, you can't come in after 10 o'clock. It's so much more engaging for the listener to imagine the grandmother under the building and imagine
yes.
the parka and no one ever finding
yeah.
You know, it's mm-hmm. it's probably sticks much better than we have a rule and you can't do something. Yeah,
it does. And so it gives us something to pass on to our own, you know, little nieces and nephews and our own children, which is what I enjoy doing when I see their faces react to these stories and their questions.
I know you told me, I think that maybe it's a grandmother or a great-grandmother that's a storyteller in your family.
Yes. Well, what my Andrews family is kind of known for, especially the women are known in my family to use a lot of expression and to use their faces, to use their sense of humor, to use their hands when they speak. And so when I would tell a story or even just tell someone about how my day went or an amazing little thing that happened in the day, somebody would look at me and say, you talk just like your Anna. You tell stories like your grandma. And, you know, people have told me that the women in my family tell stories and use their expressions in a similar way.
So maybe coming all the way down from that, is your Anna still with us or is she gone now?
Yes, she's with us, and she uses her face and her humor to really tell these stories and to teach us as well.
Yeah. So, well, that's really interesting. So it's they're sort of. Probably, I think maybe Jack, you might have said this to me, that stories are like an encyclopedia of a culture, because you can tuck in values or ways of being or ways of being in the world or the way the world works, like the glacier story that you told early on. Do you see them as categories? Do you see them as, oh, this is this kind of story and this is that kind of story? Do you break them up in your minds, Jack?
I wouldn't necessarily say that I break them up in my mind, because within one story, and the example I use is, say, the creation legend of the Yupik people or the boy who ate too much, within one story like that, you can have a teaching of values, Then also the teaching of spiritual ideas, the teaching of very practical scientific ideas, like the way that animals act, what animals are used for. You can learn about in an indigenous way of economics, you know, the quote-unquote law of supply and demand, things that are traded with other cultures. There's just so much information that can be put into one story and change the length of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The Boy Who Ate Too Much, there's a version I can tell in 30 minutes, there's another version I can tell in 60 minutes, and there's another version that goes 90 minutes or more, depending on how much detail I choose to put into the story based on who the audience is and what it is that I believe they would like to learn from the story. It's all of those things at once. So it's not like you can say, oh, this is a value story and this is a science story and this is that. There's always elements of each of those things within any story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned, by the way, if you're joining us now, this is Hometown Alaska, and we're listening to Jack Dalton and Polly Andrews. Both have told stories recently at the Alaska Native Oratory Society, and Jack, of course, has been a local storyteller and a statewide storyteller, and Polly tells stories because of her family. Her family has told stories, and she especially likes to tell stories to children. So if you'd like to call us and participate with us in this program, it's please give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. And if you have questions about Alaska Native storytelling or any other kind of storytelling, let us hear from you. And I'd sort of like to sort of pitch it to Polly and sort of, I heard you tell some wonderful stories about a week or two ago, and I just wondered if you could tell us one of those or tell us a story that you like.
Sure, I would love to share one of my favorite stories, and I think it's a favorite of some people who come from my region. It's called The Talking Biluhuks. And Biluhuks in my Chupik region are what other people would know as Mukluks. So just to be aware that when I use the word Biluhuks, I'm talking about Mukluks or traditional sealskin boots. So anyway, some of the stories that I grew up learning about were about the importance of staying neat and keeping your things neat and organized within your home. And this story really paints that picture. And it was told to me by a cousin of mine from Chivak. So a long time ago, before there were any modern homes or modern conveniences, there was a hunter out in the tundra, out in the Kisunuk region where we come from. And he had been out in the tundra subsisting all day. And after a whole day out in the tundra environments, he grew weary and he grew tired. So he went back home to his sod house. And when he got back home to his sod house, he was so tired that he took off his biluhuks. He unlaced the skin on his biluhuks, and he took his biluhuks, and without paying any mind to where he put them, he just threw them off. He threw them off into the corner, and he lay down on his bed to go to sleep, not thinking about his biluhuks or his other possessions. So while he was sleeping, he was suddenly awakened by voices, and they were coming from inside his sod house. And these were two voices, and they were speaking together in the Chupik language. And he grew so frightened because he knew he was the only one in his sod house. Nobody else was in there with him. But everything was so dark, and he couldn't see who these voices belonged to or where they were coming from in his sod house. So what he did was he lit his seal oil lamp, and he started walking in the direction of where these two voices were coming from, these two voices speaking together in the Chupik language. So he approached that area, and what he saw completely scared him. He looked, and his biluhuks were facing each other, and they were having a conversation in the Chupik language. And frozen in terror, what he did was he took those biluhuks and he put them side by side how you're supposed to keep shoes, and then they quit talking. So the reason these Bilugooks were having a conversation is because he didn't pay special careful attention to how he put his items and arranged his items in his home. He put his shoes any old way, and because of that, they were facing each other and they started having a conversation. And so that is why when we go into our house, the first thing we need to do is arrange our shoes and set them together so they won't start talking in the middle of the night. And a couple of years ago, I was with my cousin in Kalskag on the Kuskokwim, and I told her this story. She looked at me and she said, "Let's go check the shoes in the porch." And I said, "Okay." And we went over to the porch and we looked. All of the shoes were in total disarray. Some shoes were facing each other, some shoes were backwards, and some shoes were upside down. And I said, "Let's fix these." And we hurry up and we fixed our shoes and we made them all straight and arranged nicely. And then and a little while later, we got up to go to the store and we stepped outside of the door and she said, "Polly, look." And I looked down at the ground and there was one pair of shoes and they were facing each other. And I said, "You better go fix those shoes." So she took those shoes and she set them side by side and then we walked to the store. And so I just wanted to let our listeners know, when you go home, you know, no matter what you're wearing, you could be wearing your Bogs, you could be wearing your sandals or your Nike shoes or your Merrells, take your shoes and put them side by side because you don't want them to start chatting in the middle of the night.
And scaring you. It makes me think of the entryway of so many houses. You know, you go over to a house for dinner or something and everybody kicks off their shoes and sometimes you don't find your shoes on the way out. You know, somebody else, everybody has clogs, right? So somebody walks out with your clogs. So this is one way maybe of organizing it. That's very funny. Have you ever heard that one, Jack?
No, I haven't heard that one, but I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, I really like that. That's great. So I was wondering, Jack, do you think stories are changing, you know, with the idea that our attention spans are a little shorter or we have lots of distraction? Are stories getting quicker or are they staying pretty much the same way?
I think there's definitely a belief that stories are getting quicker because of people's attention spans. But when I'm here in Talkeetna doing a residency for a week, and the residencies always start off with a storytelling performance. And I tell the story of the boy who ate too much. And they always ask, "Okay, how long of an assembly do you want?" And I say, "Well, not including getting the kids there and back to the classrooms, it's a 90-minute assembly." And the teachers and the staff always go, "Oh, well, are you sure?" And I always say, you know, I've done this for hundreds of times. It's a 90-minute assembly. And they're always amazed that the kids, even the little kindergartners, will sit on a gymnasium floor for 90 minutes listening to a story. And I do that because I want people to recognize that it's not about short attention spans, but it's more about the information that we're giving people. We're giving people information in these short bursts. We're giving people information that's, you know, maybe not as important's not the right word, but not as relevant to humanity and in terms of being a human being in the world, that, you know, of course people are going to get bored by that. Or if they've heard something, you know, or they've seen a show over and over and over again, then yeah, you're not super interested in it, so you're not going to have as long of an attention towards that. But kids are absolutely able to sit for, you know, 90 minutes and listen to a story. And then the teachers say, you know, they are just as interested in the story as the kids. So
it crosses age groups easily, huh?
Yes. And so I really think it's you know, it's about the personal interaction that comes with storytelling and the fact that stories you know, especially traditional stories, are so based in humanity that everyone can connect with them.
Hmm. So Jack and Polly, we've got a caller, so we're going to bring her on. And welcome, Carolyn. You're talking to Hometown Alaska.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. This is Caroline Bolar, and I wanted to mention, before I have my comments about the Bristol Bay region, when I was a child, of course, we know all the grim fairy tales, which were designed to scare the bejeebers out of us, I think, but I remember the affirmative one, which was sung, and that was Itsy Bitsy Spider. And that had a positive end when the sun came out and he was able to go back up the spout again. And coming from Florida, my original home state, one of my first words, according to my mother, was piter, because spiders were everywhere. So this was one way of making spiders friendly, which, you know, you wanted them around because they kept down the bugs. But I remember getting out to Chivac many years ago. And, of course, the villages were so isolated that you have the Chivac dialect of Yupik and so forth. And I remember asking Joan Hamilton, bless her memory, about Chivac. And it seemed so different. Eight of the 11 teachers were Alaskan natives. And John Pingayak, who graduated in 77, he was from Chivac, and he was the principal of the school. There was a lot of difference there. And so I asked what the difference was, and Joan told me that the elders never gave up their right to keep in touch with the kids in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to make a huge difference. And as to the boy who ate too much, Father Michael Oleska told that story here in Anchorage when I went to an event that he was speaking at. And it seemed to give a caution to not be a glutton, to always consider others. And
does that sound right, Jack? Is that one of the lessons of that story?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And his book, Dr. Oleska's, Father Oleska, his book, Another Culture, Another World, in the very back of it, it talks about Yupik stories and Yupik culture, et cetera. So if anyone really wants to get a connection to those things, I think this book is very helpful. But my main question to Jack and to your other guest,
Polly,
yeah. Thank you, is to ask, have the villages been more friendly toward maintaining the culture through storytelling? And if so, how should the others change in order to achieve that that friendliness and that continuation of the story?
Well, Jack, Polly, what do you think?
Well, I'm really happy to say that still stories are shared in the education system in Chivac, and oftentimes elders are asked to come in and share culture and share stories, and that includes my grandfather and when my grandmother, and when my grandfather was still here. And many of these stories were actually told by John Pingayak, who helped preserve and keep these stories going. And yes, so I'm happy to say that elders are still going to the school, and there's still a program where these stories are being told.
Well, Caroline, thank you for that call. We're going to take a little break here, and you're listening to Jack Dalton and Polly Andrews, and they're telling us some stories, and we'll be back shortly. This is Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hello, this is Ed Ratliff, former board member for APTI and Morning Edition host, along with Beatty here on KSKA. Through NPR, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and KSKA, you hear opinions and views on issues that you may not have considered from voices you may not otherwise hear. With programs like Addressing Alaskans and A Closer Look, KSKA goes out into the community to bring you the voices, ideas, and issues that make up the fabric of South Central Alaska. And with programs like Line One, Your Health Connection, as well as Hometown Alaska, you can add your voice to the conversation about the things people are talking about throughout your community. Everything you hear here on KSKA is made possible only with your financial support. So we'd like to ask you to call now with your pledge, 550-8484, or outside Anchorage. That number is toll-free. It's 1-800-478-5256. Keep it whatever level is right for you, because every pledge counts, and more importantly, every member matters. 550-8484 or outside Anchorage, 1-800-478-5256. Thanks so much for listening, and truly thank you for supporting KSKA.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is storytelling in Alaska, and we have Polly Andrews in the studio with us, who's a UAA student studying human services, right?
Yes.
Coming from a family of storytellers, and she's told several already today, and we'll probably hear some more in the next half hour. And Jack Dalton is with us, calling in from Talkeetna, where he is a teacher in residence and telling stories there too, right, Jack?
Yet in schools, I mostly do creative writing, so from a storytelling point of view. So they hear a story, and then they learn the skills to create stories of their own that all have morals to them.
Are you talking character, plot, that sort of thing, or are you talking beginning, middle, and end? Are you talking legends? I mean, there's so much in storytelling.
Yeah, what I do is called values-based writing, and so it's kind of like writing a murder mystery. You have to know how the story ends before you can do any of the other parts. So the first thing the students do is they choose a value or a lesson they'd like to teach in their story, and then based on that lesson, everything else falls into place. And I also say for the project that they can only use animals in the story. So they're learning about metaphor and anthropomorphism, as well as plot and things like that. So it kind of encompasses as much as possible in a short period of time.
I see. And now, since you're both storytellers, I want to ask, do you generally just pass along these stories, or do you do any invention? Polly, do you do invention, or are you mostly telling the stories that you've heard or were told to you, or do you ever come up with a new one?
Oh, yes. I think that you can go out and ride the city bus and come back home after a few hours, and you'll have a story that or an incident that happened that you can convert to a story. You know, if you really use your communication and your face and your speaking, then anything can become a story in the way that you express it.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to do both, whether it's something that happened in the day or something that happened 100 years ago that I've heard from someone else.
Yeah. And how about you, Jack? Do you? I know I read on your website that you actually participated. You created a Yupik opera. So you definitely are creating things that are new. But in terms of storytelling, you know, is there a category for the traditional and then a category for the new?
Yeah, definitely so. I say that I have three different categories of stories that I tell. The traditional stories is one category. Then there's what I call modern traditionals, where I've taken traditional characters and put them in a modern environment to show how the culture has changed over time. And then I have what are called contemporary stories, which are stories I've made up. An example is a story called The Mountain That Wanted to Go to the Beach, which is about the water cycle and erosion. And then also stories about my own personal life I put into the contemporary story category.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that's really interesting regarding the caller's, Caroline's, comment about what it's like in villages, that you really, it's not like you can say, oh, this is what's happening in villages. You really need to go to every single village, because every single village has a different set of circumstances that they're dealing with culturally based on how much interaction they had with non-Native people during the trading days, which church was established there during the missionary times. All of those things have very, very interesting effects on how culture, story, and things like dance have been continued in that. And I think Chivac was really, really, really lucky that the set of circumstances between who was, because I know that Hooper Bay people are kind of jealous of Chivac people because of that. They had less interaction with the Western world, and they just so happened to have really strong elders who told whoever the missionaries were, you know, hey, this is the way we're going to do it here, and you just kind of have to deal with that. So I think that was really, really lucky, whereas other villages have almost completely lost some of the traditions.
It's so almost they created an ecosystem so the stories can survive. I mean, they're told and the elders are brought into the school. But if things like that don't happen, then maybe the stories will be forgotten.
Exactly. Yeah. And the situation is very, very different in each village that you go to.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I just want to put our phone numbers out there for folks who might want to call and ask about storytelling or even tell us a short story. You can do that at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 if you're outside of Anchorage. And we'll take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I wanted to let people know about two storytelling opportunities that there are in Anchorage, and I just want to throw these out. They're on our website. There's the Alaska Native Oratory Society, which we have a link to that, and that seems to be it celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, and it sounds as if Alaska Native, Native American, and non-Native storytellers are invited as an opportunity to actually be able to stand up and argue for things that you value. It's almost like a leadership opportunity, almost. That's the way they describe it on their website. And then the other one is Arctic Entries, which is also a website, and it has it's an organization for urban storytellers. I saw on their website it's 7 stories in 7 minutes, or 7-minute stories, 7 of them, or something like that. And they have an event coming up May 15th with a theme, which is going to be building things. They've had theme nights and things like Law and Order or Paws and Claws, but this time it's going to be building things. So you can check on alaskapublic.org if you want to kind of drill down and figure out how you can participate in that. So those are two storytelling opportunities. There may be others here that I don't even know about, but it does, I'm pretty convinced that humans really love stories, and I thought maybe we would go back to Polly or Jack. Who's got a story that they'd like to tell?
Don't go ahead, Polly.
You're right. Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell another one that I remember growing up with in my childhood. And this one was about, it was one of the many reasons why we should always come home before the sunset or before midnight or before it got too dark. And in this particular story, which was also told to me by a cousin from the Kisunik region or from Chivak, it was about, and she told me that this happened to several people in our community, so it really made me want to listen and to follow what she was saying. So in this particular story, we know that if we stay out late, when we come home, there might be a dark, mysterious figure standing in front of the doorway. So, and this has happened to several people in our community, and they've come home late at night to find this dark figure standing in front of their door. And we're told, when you encounter this dark being in front of the door, you can't just walk through it or walk past it. You need to follow a certain set of instructions to get past this dark being. And what we have to do is, no matter how terrified we are to face this dark being, no matter how scared we are, what we need to do is lift our hand, place our hand on this dark figure's chest, and begin rubbing this figure. Now we take our other hand and put our other hand on top of this figure's head. And while we are rubbing this being, we have to push down with our other hand and watch the being slowly disappear into the ground. Even though we're filled with terror and filled with fright, and even though this being, this dark being, is cold, we still need to rub this being in the chest and push down on his head so he disappears into the ground, and then we'll be free to step over and open the door and go inside. And we're told, you can't just leave your porch and try to run to your auntie's house or run to your cousin's house, because that being will follow you and that being will be in front of their door. So either way, you need to be brave and face this dark, cold being and follow these instructions until it goes all the way through the floor. And so a few years after I heard that story, I was back in Chivac, and I went to go visit my auntie, and she and I were visiting when I noticed how late it got and how dark it got. And I thought, gee, I got to go home back to my Anna and my family. They're waiting for me. I can't be out this late. So I stepped outside of the porch of my auntie, and I was immediately frozen in fear when to the left of me, I could see the outline of a dark being standing there. And I got so scared. I just couldn't believe it. I thought to myself, oh, I'm so sorry for staying out late, and look at this being is standing in front of me. So what I did was I extended my hand to touch this dark being that was standing in front of me, and it crinkled. And I thought, what? And I started to feel this dark being some more, and it crinkled some more. Well, what it was somebody's coat hanging on a nail. And I could only see the outline of it, and I thought to my, I was so thankful. I thought, oh, man, I'm not going to stay out late anymore. And I walked home, and I was grateful I was given another chance.
Get a second chance. That's great. We have a caller. Let's find out. Hi, Steve.
Stu, maybe.
Oh, I'm sorry. Stu, you're right. Hi, Stu. Okay. You're calling from Muldoon.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking about Tetitlik there, I was on a beach with a Russian-Israeli immigre, and we were sitting around a campfire not far from there, and he started talking, and I used one of the words, I think it's Yiddish or Hebrew, chutzpah, which I probably picked up from NPR. And I just wanted to see if he could talk about it. You know, I was trying to start up a conversation, and he said, yeah, chutzpah. I have a story about it. And, of course, chutzpah is sometimes used in English for courageous action or maybe a slang for balls or something along those lines. And I just wanted to see if it translated to him. And his story went like this. He said there was a guy in Israel who killed his parents, both his mom and dad. And when he went to trial, he said to the judge, "Your Honor, please show me mercy. I'm an orphan." Okay. But, you know, it's a joke, right? But if you think about it, I mean, this is a person who was most definitely ill. He killed both his parents, and he stated a fact. He's responsible for the situation that he created, but it actually raises a lot of questions which are relative to our society when you're dealing with mentally ill people who do terrible things. And it's actually a great fireside story to share, and it raises the question of who is responsible when terrible things happen with people who may not be responsible.
Jack, are there stories that you know of coming out of Alaska that deal with, you know, responsibility for your actions?
Oh, I think that almost every story has that underlying. I mean, both the stories that Polly has told, I can think most of the stories I've told have to do with responsibility on some level. Mm-hmm. What I can say is I don't know of any particular stories that someone said, oh, that's about someone with a mental illness. I think it's because different cultures see mental illness in such different ways that I don't think there's a real, that I know of, a specific way of saying, oh, well, that happened because that person was mentally ill. In the same way that we think about mental illness nowadays.
Well, thank you, Stu.
Bye-bye.
Jackie, I wanted to ask you, actually, I want you to have a chance to talk about a class that you're going to teach this summer, which is an opportunity that people might be interested in. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so Maria Williams, who's the director of the Alaska Native Studies Program at the University of Alaska Anchorage, we were on a panel discussion about Native literature last fall, and afterwards she said, how would you like to teach a class at the university next summer? And I was like, really? And she said, yeah, tell me what you want to teach, and we'll think about it. So I was thinking about that story from Tetitlik and some of the other stories we discussed there, but particularly the one about the glaciers and the volcanoes. And I thought, you know, I would really love to be able to facilitate a class in which people can find more of these stories in anthropological texts and really suss them out to try and figure out what was the original story like? What was the original intent like? And try and sort of repatriate them back to native peoples. And so the wonderfully academic name for the class is The Decolonization and Repatriation of Traditional Oral Narrative in Anthropological Texts.
Wow. That is a mouthful. So, and that's a summer course. Is that like a 5-week course or a 10-week course over at UAA?
Let's see, it runs from June, I think it's June 27th through August 4th, so that's a 5-week course. It is 3 credits. I think it's each time we meet, we're meeting for 3 hours. And so there'll be, but it's going to be a very, very interactive course. I really want us to, there'll be some sort of philosophy about storytelling in general and what it means to transliterate, translate, and interpret and things like that, cultural background. But I really want to give students, especially native students, a chance to find texts in their from their own cultures and then from their own cultural point of view, you know, without too many outside people saying, oh, well, this is what I think your story means, but to give people a chance to rediscover those stories from their own cultures.
Right.
But certainly if other people are interested, I mean, I don't want to say this isn't for people who aren't, you know, anyone who's interested definitely would welcome them.
So native, non-native students, but just people who are interested in stories.
Yeah, yeah. And also the how stories have evolved. You know, mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because obviously when we in the modern days look at these stories, we're going to look at them through modern eyes. So that's going to be a partial, you know, that's going to help the it's going to be a part of the evolution of that story.
Right, almost unpacking it in contemporary times or putting it into contemporary context.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I wanted to ask both of you a little bit about, you know, digital tools like video and audio and things like that. Do you see that coming into storytelling? Do you maybe are there discs out there for, I mean, there's something very special about a storyteller and an audience, you know, and where you can see their eyes, you can see the storyteller's eyes, and the storyteller can see the audience and see how they're reacting. And I mean, can that be translated into video and audio? What do you think? Or do you think it's a one-on-one transaction, or, you know, storyteller to audience transaction?
Well, I'd have to say from my own experience in a rural community, all these stories were told orally and face-to-face, somewhere in very close areas, like taking a steam together. You know, that's a very personal time, and it's one-on-one, and it's a time for self-disclosure and a time for sharing. And I think traditional storytelling is a very oral and personal experience.
Yeah. So it's not as easy for it to translate to a video that you could watch on YouTube or just a recording. How about you, Jack? Have you dealt? I think you said you were in Bethel at a digital conference, right?
Yeah. The Lower Kuskokwim School District had done some projects with kids dealing with either puppetry or digital storytelling. I think my view on that, any time that you can have a face-to-face interaction with a storyteller is going to far exceed any other kind of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, in today's world, you know, we tend to, forget. What was it? At one point, they said books were going to keep people from talking to each other.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, every time a new technology has come along, a new communications technology has come along, it's always said to threaten the oral tradition that came before that. And yet, I think we can look at these things and say, well, they haven't necessarily extinguished the oral traditions. They might have altered them in some way, but if they're used correctly, they can really help enhance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to share the ideas with a broader audience, but also at the same time encourage people have those interactions together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really the best way to do it. That's
your thought. Well, I wanted to close out with a scary story. And Jack, I was going to turn to you, and we have, I would say, only 3 minutes. Can you do one in 3 minutes?
Well, we'll do our best shot, okay?
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Scare us.
Buckle your seatbelts, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Scary Story flight to Bethel. So a long time ago, there was a village where there were these naughty, naughty kids who never did anything they were told to do by their parents, by the other adults, by the elders, even by that oldest lady in the village who everyone was scared of. They never did what they were told. And one night when they were out too late and playing around and making too much noise, they went down to the beach and they could see as the sun set that there was this glow under the water. And the kids were so amazed because that glow started getting closer and closer and closer until finally the fire jumped up out of the water and all the kids jumped back. "What's that?" they asked. "I don't know." But as this came further out of the water, they could see that it was a hand that had sharp, gnashing teeth and mouths at the end of each finger. And the further it came out of the water, they could see a big eye on the palm of the hand looking for naughty children. The kids got so scared and ran back towards the village, and the big fiery hand got down on the tippy tips of its fingers so it could run around like a spider. And it chased those kids back to the village, and when it got back to the village, it ate all of those kids up, no matter where they were hiding. The next morning, all of the parents and adults woke up, and they realized all the kids were gone except for two orphans. And those orphans helped devise a plan, and that night they went down to the beach, made a lot of noise like they were supposed to not do, and that big fiery hand came back out and chased them back into the village. They went to the qasrik, or the big man's house in the center of the village, and hid in two baskets. And the big fiery hand came in, and it was going to eat them up, but the boys jumped out with their little knives and attacked that hand, and the men came in with their hunting tools and attacked that hand, and soon the hand was gone, and everyone rejoiced. And now the kids hear that story today and say, "Yay, now we can do whatever we want." But the storyteller is always there to say, "It is true, the big fiery hand is dead, but do not forget, the big fiery hand had a wife. She's very angry. We kill her husband, and she's wading out underneath the waves, and she has put out her fire so you cannot see her coming, and she waits for one child to do something wrong so she can come out and eat you up. So good night, sleep tight, and remember that we tell you these stories because we love you."
Jack, thank you. That was wonderful. That was wonderful. I'm scared, and I'm gonna make sure I get home in time. So, I just really want to thank you, Polly Andrews and Jack Dalton, for coming in and sharing these stories and talking about where they come from and why they have value. It's really been fabulous. And don't forget about our website. Arctic Entries is listed there. More information about the Alaska Oratory Society. Next week on Hometown Alaska, we have host Charles Walforth, and he'll discuss the tourism economy in Alaska, especially economic impacts and troubles at the Alaska Railroad. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.